Okay, well, we are thrilled to be here on yet another Blogging Heads. I'm Rachel Kleinfeld. I'm the CEO and co-founder of the Truman National Security Project, and thrilled to be here with my counterpart.
I am Robert Farley. I'm an assistant professor at the Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce at the University of Kentucky.
Great, and we're here today to talk about whether there is a progressive security policy and whether there's something that unites all of us as progressives.
Indeed.
Do you want to take that away?
Sure, but I always ask how's the weather first. That's sort of a tradition for me.
How's the weather?
It is
pouring cats and dogs in Washington, D.C., and it will be very nice to have a weekend where we're not all dressed up in our work clothes and wandering through the rain.
Right. It's actually it's drizzling in Baltimore right now. It is not pouring cats and dogs, but there is a nice drizzle, and it's mid 60s. So it's actually not such a bad day, even if you have to go out in it just a little bit. So that's kind of
Baltimore needs all the help it can get. Sorry, I just alienated a good portion of our audience there.
That's I suppose.
I'm just joking. I'm heading there later this afternoon.
Oh well, that's cool. Regarding this question of whether there is a progressive security policy, and if there is, what this progressive security policy is, I know that you work in an institution that is sort of, in some sense, dedicated to the project of creating and sort of delineating and spreading progressive security ideas and a progressive security policy. I don't really work in the same kind of institution, more of an academic institution, but I'm still interested. I'm progressive and I'm interested in security policy, so there's still a professional interest there. I'm sure that you've heard the critiques, and the critiques are pretty common, that there are a number of progressive security critiques, or a number of lines of progressive security critique of foreign policy and of security policy, but there is not in and of itself a progressive security policy, a positive developed progressive security policy. Is this what you hear, or am I barking up the wrong tree?
No, I think you've got a really good point. Certainly one hears that a lot. I don't think it's necessarily true, but I do think that there are a couple of national security policies that progressives promulgate and a couple of foreign policies that those aren't the same thing.
Right.
And that there's a lot of dissension in the ranks, so it's a big topic worth discussing.
Right. And I think that it's fair to make a distinction between, not all progressives hold to what is sort of a broader liberal internationalist attitude on foreign policy, but certainly a fair number of progressives hold to this, and I think that liberal internationalism would be a good way of describing both of the two most recent democratic administrations. But that, liberal internationalism contains the possibility for many different progressive security policies. And what I hear from, argued from some people on the right and some people who are just sort of interested in this is that, liberal internationalism is fine and well, but it does not constitute or mandate a security policy. And so you actually need some sort of positive security policy, even whether within the framework of liberal internationalism or alongside or even running counter to some of the elements of liberal internationalism. That progressives need to develop this kind of security policy, need to develop the institutions and the organs that that create and maintain the security policy and so forth.
Sure. I think it's funny that you keep using the word liberal internationalism because Matt Spence, who now works on the National Security Council and was the co-founder of Truman with me, banned me from ever using those words. I used to throw them around all the time with abandon, and Matt said, look, Rachel, nobody knows what you're talking about. You got to quit it. And I've taken that advice, but I'm actually, those of you on the Blogging Heads world don't know it, but I'm a little late to this interview because I was giving a talk on Capitol Hill on exactly this. We teach congressional staff about national security, and our first class always goes through what are the different kinds of national security philosophies on the left and on the right. And it's funny, I'll throw out there pacifism, and I'll get my one-sentence answer, and I'll say anti-imperialism, get the one-sentence answer. Liberal internationalism, nobody knows what it means. And I think that's a big problem. It's a big tent. It says something about creating stability through trade. It says something about creating stability through international institutions. Doesn't say a lot about the military. Doesn't say a lot about the use of force. doesn't say a lot about transnational threats and non-nation state threats.
Right.
So I think you're absolutely right.
Right, that's really interesting. So what ages are the people you normally deal with in these kinds of classes?
The security scholars, they tend to be in their 20s. They're generally LAs on the Hill, so that's legislative assistants, Senate and House. And they're whip smart. They always have a lot of great ideas, and they often have a lot of education in foreign policy. But quite often they need the background in hard security issues, defense budgeting, military issues, that sort of thing.
Right. I'm sort of curious whether if you had because the Clinton administration and people around the Clinton administration threw around the term liberal internationalism quite a lot, and it does mean I think you made quite clear what it means, which is commitment to international institutions, commitment to a leadership role, sort of a first among equals role for the United States in a international system that is structured by international institutions and that favors free international trade, that favors institutionalized use of force when it favors use of force at all. And I think that the Clinton administration was fairly clear on what that meant, and maybe sort of in the last 8 years of backing away from liberal internationalism, we've lost, or at least among a certain segment, we've lost an understanding of what that is. But that's kind of interesting. I also teach liberal internationalism to my students who are also in their 20s. So I
think one of the things that's very interesting about what happened over the last 8 years with Bush is that you saw a coming together of different tribes on the left. So you saw the pacifists, who were opposed to force in every case, team up with the anti-imperialists, who were against the use of force if a stronger power was doing it to a weaker power, which in this case was the U.S. versus Iraq. And then team up with the realists on the right and the left, which was kind of new to have realists on the left, who said, look, this wasn't a war in our national interest. And so you got this whole smorgasbord of ideas turning around that all were pushing us out of Iraq. And what you didn't hear very much of was the liberal internationalist view, because it didn't have much to say about Iraq.
Well,
and now, sorry.
Oh, I mean, I think it went a little bit beyond that. That many of the prominent liberal internationalists were sort of, from our point of hindsight, were wrong about Iraq, right? Many of the people who were so fairly forceful in developing a liberal internationalist point of view in the during the Clinton administration were either fairly mute on Iraq or they were in favor of the war in Iraq, and I think that helped.
Sure, I think there was a mix for sure of folks who had backed it, people who were quiet, people who were against it, but against it for a fairly complicated set of reasons and very hard to explain to a lot of people with a simpler set of reasons where they fell on that ideological spectrum. Now what you've got is, okay, now we're in power. If you're in power, it's very difficult to maintain an anti-imperialist viewpoint because you're the power. You can't really be against your own use of power. You could be against your use of force, but not necessarily against the U.S. using its power to achieve goals in the world, unless you really are anti-American. So that becomes a very difficult position to maintain when you've got the presidency and the Senate and the House. And so the anti-imperialists are a little bit confused as to what to say, although they're certainly pushing to get out of Afghanistan very quickly. The pacifists are pushing to get out of Afghanistan, but that's perfectly legitimate. That's their constant position. They're always against the next war. That's what pacifism is all about. And now I think there's a real job for liberal internationalists to explain what a positive foreign policy would be for this administration. Why, just because George Bush supported democracy, it's not necessarily a Republican thing. You know, there's a big conference coming up in a couple of weeks with Newt Gingrich and Mitt Romney and all these folks about democracy. And it's not as if they ever cared about the rights of women or the rights of minorities or any of the things democracy brings. But suddenly they see it as something they can use to hurt the Obama administration. So they're going to grab it and run.
Right. It's often mentioned that conservatives will talk about the plight of women in Afghanistan, and not a single conservative was even faintly interested in the plight of women in Afghanistan prior to September 11th, 2001. And so it just becomes a talking point. So, I mean, you're right. We have this grand coalition that developed in opposition to the Iraq War, and that now is predictably, I think, falling apart, because you have some of the organs of what's supposed to be a progressive security policy favoring deeper engagement with Iraq. I mean, you have, or with Afghanistan, you have the administration itself, which is pretty clear in terms of its commitment for a greater engagement with Afghanistan against the Taliban, and yet you have you have pacifist anti-imperialists who I think are actually, I mean, they play an interesting role in the progressive foreign policy coalition. I think that they're quite small, but that their ideas are sort of a relevant sounding board for everything else that has to go on in the progressive conversation, right? That they have ideas out there that have to be answered, even if the actual numbers of pacifists and anti-imperialists are pretty small. But I think you also...
And why is that, do you think?
Why are there few pacifists? Well, for one, when we talk about pacifism, you know, normally we're not actually talking about pacifists, right? I mean, when we talk about pacifists in terms of the being on the spectrum of American political thought on foreign policy, I mean, we're almost always talking about people who think that force should be used under some circumstances, just not very often, right? I mean, you won't often hear a pacifist arguing that we shouldn't, or someone who's treated as a pacifist arguing that we shouldn't defend Florida from, some invasion. And so, in that
sense, although you did hear them during the Civil War. I mean, we had the what were they called, the Copperheads,
right?
Saying during the Civil War we should give up the South and let it be because it's not worth this amount of killing.
Right. That's a pragmatic case.
Even though very few folks would admit to themselves that they were true, honest pacifists.
Right.
In fact, I think a larger proportion of folks are than we usually give them credit for.
Well, I mean, I think it's hard to be part of a state and be a pacifist, right? Because states are about violence, and you know everything that a state does is violent in some sense. But you know, you can still usefully describe some component of the coalition as pacifist because they do tend to be. I mean, and I think the pacifists and the anti-imperialists are very close together. Although with the anti-imperialists, you do get some support for sort of national liberation movements and so forth. Although you know, even that's sort of different than it was 20 years ago. And so, I mean, so one of the questions in terms of developing and thinking about a progressive security policy is how do you include and how do you react to the critiques that pacifists and anti-imperialists make without allowing those notions, which are really quite powerful. I mean, I guess one way to make a metaphor would be to say that if you're cooking a stew of progressive security policy, even in very small amounts, pacifism and anti-imperialism can really change the flavor of the stew. And so how do you include...
Beautiful way of putting it.
Thank you. How do you include those, and how do you sort of do justice to those viewpoints without allowing them to dominate what is sort of a larger stew of progressive security policy? And I think that people have a lot of trouble with that.
I think that's a very wise way to put it. As a cook, I'm now going to start thinking of them as cayenne pepper and cilantro or something.
Right.
So I think it's a very wise question. And let's take a couple of practical issues here. I think it'd be worth looking at Iraq and Afghanistan, possibly worth looking at Iran, and just look through how would you deal with those given those elements of the progressive palette. I think, for instance, with regards to Iran, if we allow the pacifist and anti-imperialist viewpoint to have too much salience early on, it might actually stop us from deterring Iran from violence and having a bomb, because one of the ways that you deter is by keeping the threat of military force in your back pocket.
Right.
I don't think anyone wants to use military force against Iran. I personally think it would be insane to go to war with Iran. But to allow that to be taken off the table early is not a great way to go into negotiations. So that'd be a case where I think Obama would really have to fight his left flank in order to negotiate well with that country.
Right, right. And I think it's worth noting that in terms of Iran, it is it's entirely legitimate to believe, and even to say sort of straightforwardly and outright, that an Iranian nuclear weapon is not as bad as all of the bad outcomes that would stem from a preemptive attack on Iran, or preventive attack on Iran, excuse me. But, you know, you still have to have the lurking threat of violence there at some point, because, you know, of all the things that Iran could do, there has to be some sort of deterrent, right? Even if you concede that Iran, or that you can't really stop Iran from getting a nuclear weapon, and that it's not worth attacking Iran to stop them from getting a nuclear weapon, you know, you still do have the threat of violence there in the back, because you have to, or at least most people, and I think most progressive things, you ought to defend American allies in the region, and not just Israel, but also Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and so forth, mm-hmm. from an Iranian attack. And that requires a position that makes possible the use of violence.
Yeah, I think that's true. And, you know, it's an interesting issue with Afghanistan. I was talking yesterday to two individuals from CENTCOM, the Central mm-hmm. Command that is our military theater that covers Afghanistan as well as a lot of the Middle East and so on, mm-hmm. and asking them how these recent elections affected the strategy and how the fraudulence of these elections affected what they were doing in Afghanistan. And a counterpart of mine asked them point blank about the pacifist and anti-imperial critique, particularly the anti-imperialist critique, mm-hmm. that's starting to gain a lot of salience on the left, this idea that the insurgency is getting worse because America is there,
right.
that it's our very footprint there that is causing the pushback. And I was fascinated to hear them say not only was that crazy, but we had with us a human rights activist who does quite a lot of human rights work on the ground in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, look, not only is America's footprint not causing this blowback, but security is the main thing that Afghans want. And even though I'm a human rights and development activist who's working in Afghanistan for that, the security is more important than the development.
Right.
And what we need is the correct strategy, the right types of boots on the ground, using them in the right ways. But that viewpoint that America is causing the problem is 100% wrong.
Right.
And then one of the folks in CENTCOM said, well, it is 100% wrong. However, the salience of it is that where American troops are is an area that's more likely to be attacked.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that Americans are causing the insurgency, but it's more like there's a lot of ants on the ground, and the ants are going to go where the butter is.
Right.
You know, that's what ants do. So, yes, the insurgents are going to attack where the Americans are, but, and this was the human rights activist again jumping in, where there is peace, where there is quiet and calm and quiescence, doesn't mean that there's stability. It often means that the Taliban have taken over and have created a reign of fear in that town.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you still have the ants all over the picnic. There's just no butter to make them show up against a yellow background, as it were.
Right.
So it was a fascinating view in direct answer to this from liberal standpoint and from the military standpoint.
Right. I think that with Afghanistan too, that you're also having many of the old style realists creeping in along with the anti-imperialists. Right. Old style realists aren't anti-imperialists. But they do have many of the same attitudes, because, you know, it's not that realists don't care about things like human rights and things like democracy and so forth. It's just that they don't see those necessarily as useful or achievable goals of American foreign policy. And so from the realists who are sort of same realists who came out against the Iraq War, you're also having sort of a growing realist resistance to greater engagement in Afghanistan. And it's working against sort of this you know, what we had previously described as liberal internationalist human rights advocacy and so forth, with regards to the conflict in Afghanistan, that you are having a development of a coalition against the war that's spanning some ideological viewpoints.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's a pity because we are certainly not in Afghanistan to bring women's rights. I mean, you don't do that
right.
through war.
Right.
We're not there to bring human rights. You also don't do that through war.
Right.
We're there because of the Al-Qaeda insurgents there and the fact that they've already attacked us and they've attacked Europe a number of times. And
mm-hmm.
that's why we're there. But it's a pity that there aren't more folks in the progressive coalition who understand that one of the repercussions of us not being there is that the human rights situation gets much, much worse. The women's rights situation gets much, much worse. It might be a side effect, but from a progressive standpoint, it's a pretty salient one.
Right, and I think that's absolutely right. And even to the, you know, it's a very difficult set of trade-offs to make. But I mean, some of the recent reaction to the German order, a German requested airstrike on the two fuel trucks that killed 120 people, some percentage of which were insurgents and some percentage of which were civilians, that the local authorities seem to be much more agitated by the fact that the Germans didn't show up and didn't make any effort to sort of control the situation than with the actual civilian casualties. But there's a trade-off there. There's a trade-off between, because this sort of any sort of state building is quite messy and inevitably produces situations like the one that you just had, unfortunately.
But what do you think about it? What do you think should be the role of state building and counterinsurgency in a progressive foreign policy?
I mean, this is I've been discussing this a lot with some friends of mine who work in some Washington think tanks, and there is, you know, among a fair number of people, a lot of skepticism about the coin revolution, a lot of skepticism about what coin actually offers. There was the first debate about counterinsurgency, which is saying that, well, counterinsurgency is just imperialism dressed up in something different, right? It's just the toolbox of imperialism, which never made any sense to me, right? I mean, even from an anti-imperialist point of view, the United States was quite capable at starting wars of imperial conquest well before it had any notion of what counterinsurgency was, right? Donald Rumsfeld hated counterinsurgency, and nevertheless started two wars of, you know, one of war of retribution, one of war of conquest, and it just meant that those wars were ineptly executed, not that they didn't happen. You know, I think the problem with counterinsurgency right now, and with the coin turn in the U.S. Army, which I still think is one of the most remarkable developments of the last 10 years, and sort of an organizational turnaround, I think that part of the problem right now is that the coin question is being folded into the greater question of, does it make strategic sense to remain in Afghanistan? And those two questions are related, but they're not exactly the same. They contribute to each other in some sense, but they're not the same question, right? And so attacking COIN and attacking COIN advocates essentially for wanting to wage the war in Afghanistan is, I think, almost making a category error. I do think that COIN, right, having an army that is, and having military forces that are structured around, or that at least have COIN capabilities, is actually a relevant and important part of a progressive foreign policy, of any foreign policy in which you are conceiving of the possibility of any intervention, right? And you can even put as many restrictions on that intervention as you want, right? You can say that it has to be UN mandated. You can say that it has to be approved by a democratic coalition. You can say that it can only be undertaken in cases of genocide or something else that's really horrible. But in any of those cases, having a COIN capability still helps. Right, whatever justificatory apparatus you want to put around an intervention, it still helps to be able to conduct the intervention, and COIN makes you able to conduct that intervention. And so I do think that COIN capability and COIN capacities plays a pretty important role in what I would think would be a sensible formulation of a progressive security policy, a progressive foreign and security policy. And if I could go one step farther, I think that some of this is revealed by the critiques of COIN that come from the right. Right? I mean, there are left critiques of COIN and there are right critiques of COIN, and the right critiques of COIN come from folks like Ralph Peters, and it's straightforward. Right? COIN is awful because it doesn't butcher enough people. Right? I mean, the answer in Afghanistan is that we need to butcher more people. The answer in Iraq is that we need to butcher more people. The answer in Vietnam was that we needed to butcher more people, and that's just really scary and terrifying to me. And the fact that these right critics seem to be so threatened by COIN tells me that maybe there is something there that progressives need to pay attention to. right, that progressives need to take into account when they're making these arguments.
Boy, I couldn't agree more, at the risk of creating an incredibly boring Blogging Heads episode here. I think you're absolutely right. One of the what is COIN? The basic counterinsurgency tenet is population-centric. You focus on the population, not on the enemy. You build a population that likes you. How do you do that? You do good things for the population. You give them security. You help them develop. And then they will flush out the bad guys and get them out of the system. And either they will get rid of them internally. There will just be fewer of them created. Or they'll push them out of the society so that they can be killed or imprisoned or what have you, whatever is the best solution.
Right.
That's the nuts and bolts of COIN in a nutshell, and it seems so progressive that it's hard for me to envision progressives having trouble with it unless they're just opposed to any intervention at all and they don't want intervention to work. You know, if what you want actually is every intervention to fail so that you never intervene, then you wouldn't want to do COIN because it's actually a workable strategy for these very difficult interventions. But other than that, something that reduces civilian casualties, increases development in poor countries, and helps people's lives get better so they like America more, so they get rid of people who would like to hurt us and hurt them.
Right.
That seems like a pretty progressive strategy to me.
Right.
Now, when you look at the right-wing critiques, I think one of the interesting things is one of the things that I was teaching about today is the right and the left have very different ways of looking at evil within our society. The left, or the right, let me take them first, tends to say, look, there are specific bad apples, there are evil people. Those bad apples need to get killed or imprisoned for a long time if we're talking about crime.
Right.
And that's the problem with society, certain bad people. And the left tends to look at these issues and say, bad people are created by bad situations, and while that doesn't make them any less bad or any less evil, let's look at those situations, let's look at that society, and how can we make that society healthier? And all the time, this is called moral relativism on the right.
Right.
And the right says, oh, you don't get it, these are evil people, you have to punish them. And the left conjoiner is always, look, of course these are bad people, these people have to be dealt with. If it's the 19 bombers 8 years ago on today,
right,
on September 11th, or terrorists in general, of course you have to get rid of those people in whatever way is appropriate for a war or a criminal situation. But counterinsurgency says you can build more of those people or you can have fewer of those people.
Right.
And boy, wouldn't it be nice if we had fewer of those people, because that way we don't have to put as many of our people at risk trying to get rid of them. And that seems to me a fundamentally progressive way of looking at warfare. It's not always appropriate. You don't always have counterinsurgency because you don't always have insurgency.
Right.
But if you're in an insurgency situation, it would be good to rally around a strategy that works and it's basically about helping people.
Right. It's interesting that you. I'm happy that you framed it in these terms, because I was going to bring up this. There was a post at the U.S. Naval Institute a few weeks ago. Their blog. I mean, you probably don't read their blog, but I mean, it's kind of interesting if you're interested in maritime affairs. And the argument came down essentially to this: that some people are naive and think that pirates aren't evil. But really, in fact, it's obvious that pirates are evil, because, you know, pirates do all sorts of horrible things. And so it's really absurd, and this was making reference to the Maersk Alabama and the shooting of the, I can't recall if it was two or three Somali pirates who were killed in the rescue of Captain Phillips. And it was saying, you know, essentially the argument was, well, we shouldn't cry for these pirates because they were evil. And my response was, that's one way to look at it, right? It's not a terribly useful way to look at it, right? In fact, you can simultaneously believe that these pirates ought to have been killed in the pursuit of saving Captain Phillips, who was almost entirely blameless in this affair and was, you know, in his own way quite heroic. You can simultaneously believe that they had to be killed, and you can believe that they would not be out there if there were any sort of reasonable opportunities for young Somali men in Somali society today. These are not notions that are in conflict with one another, right? You can be happy that Captain Phillips was saved, while at the same time being unhappy that these young men who, in better circumstances, simply would have been fishermen or would not have been out there, had to be killed in order to save Captain Phillips. And that's, I think, as you suggest, that is a perspective that many on the right associate with moral relativism. But I think it's really that kind of understanding goes to the core of what needs to be part of a progressive security policy. Progressive security policy needs to understand that while force is necessary, force is always sort of morally ambiguous. It needs to, in other words, it needs to take into account the fact of moral ambiguity in the use of force in the world, rather than simply treating the use of force in triumphal terms.
Absolutely. And, you know, Peter Beinart made that point very beautifully in The Good Fight, his book, that one of the things that progressives can do for the American polity is provide this sense that you can be moral and still understand the ambiguity of power and force.
Right.
I've got a quote that I have in my house that says, doubt is difficult, but certainty is absurd. And to me, that sums it up. It's not easy to keep in mind doubt while you're taking positive positions. But to be certain about anything in this realm, we don't do scientific tests in foreign policy.
Right.
It's crazy. So it seems to me one thing we can do as progressives is allow that moral ambiguity, but it becomes problematic when we let it paralyze us and act as if doing nothing is generally a morally favorable thing to doing something.
Right.
And I think a lot of times that's a problem in progressive thought, that if we don't act, then we're not doing anything wrong. When, in fact, America, as the biggest power in the world right now, if we don't act, we're often causing harm just as much as if we were acting. And so, you know, when you're an elephant, everywhere you put your foot is going to get smashed, and you have to pick where you put your foot. And there's no easy way to make those decisions.
Right. No,
but,
there is always
morally
a...
morally culpable for making them.
Right. There is always a line from Rush, right? If you choose not to decide, you still have made a choice, right? And that will be the last time that I ever quote Rush in a Blogging Heads episode.
I'm sure Rush was quoting someone else there. You're fine, I'm sure.
Right. Well, hopefully. Inactivity is not inactivity, right? And when we go back to the coup in Honduras, some people were calling for the United States to be very active, and other people were calling for the United States to stay out. And whatever the United States does is a political act in that sense, right? If we don't say anything, then we are essentially saying that the coup plotters were okay. If we condemn, then we're engaging in another political act. If we support Zelaya, I think his name was, then we're engaged in another political act, right? There is nothing apolitical. There is no way to not intervene politically in the situation in Honduras, right? Simply because of the structure of the situation. There is no non-interventionist option. It's just you're simply debating which interventionist options are the most just, which interventionist options are the most practically defensible, and so forth. And I think this one is actually this is one that gets to an issue that's difficult for a progressive security policy to think through, because it's difficult for me to think it through. What do you think, and what sort of do you think, how do you, not what do you think progressives should think, but how should progressives think through the drone war in Afghanistan and Pakistan?
Boy, that's a really tough one. I just finished Peter Singer's book, which is a fantastic book. Mm-hmm. I'll send a little shout out to him, called Wired at War, or Wired for War, which is all about the robotics revolution and war, and goes through a lot of the ethical issues that it brings up. On the one hand, of course, we should be for fewer young men and women in America putting their lives on the line. I spent yesterday with 150 veterans who we brought to the Hill to talk about climate change. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you meet these people and you hear what they've been going through and hear them talking about pulling their buddies out of flaming vehicles because those vehicles caught on fire because they were carrying oil. Mm-hmm. You can't want more of those people to have to be on the ground. But my feeling with drones is that it's a little bit like the Bosnian War, and that on the one hand, it protects us, and there are some really useful times when that is necessary and essential. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, it actually makes the U.S. look weaker, especially in honor cultures and in places where honor plays such a big role, Afghanistan being one of those places. America looks weak when we're not willing to engage in a, frankly, man-to-man fight.
Right.
And old-fashioned as that sounds, that matters. You don't want the enemy to think that you're weak. You don't want the enemy to think fundamentally that you're not willing to fight and that you're hiding behind this cyborg kind of gear.
Right.
That can harm our ability to fight. It can prolong a war. And so I think it's very problematic, and we certainly want to be aware of that reading of it by our enemies. And then, of course, there's the whole issue of civilian casualties. I don't think drones are likely to cause more civilian casualties than just using airplanes, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We saw that in the Bosnian War. The problem is fighting from afar versus fighting from near. It might cause a little more dehumanization by the people who are using the drones because they're back in America. They're not anywhere near the battlefield,
right.
Often, not always. But I think you're fundamentally talking about war from the air versus war from closer to the ground. And in honor cultures, boy, I think it's hard not to fight a close-to-the-ground war if you're actually going to win. And certainly
right.
in counterinsurgency, you're not right. going to win that way.
Right. I mean, I think that, one problem... I mean, I think you detail a couple of the serious questions. A couple more issues. One is the civilian, definitely, with that drones, like airstrikes more generally, just aren't necessarily all that great at distinguishing between targets and civilians. And so, as with B-1 bombers, as with F-18s and F-16s and so forth, you inevitably create civilian casualties, and one hallmark of a progressive foreign policy ought to be that you should kill the people who need to be killed and not kill the people who don't need to be killed, right? I mean, if there's one cornerstone, that's a cornerstone of it. I would say that another cornerstone of a progressive security policy needs to be some sort of understanding of the relevance of international law and the relevance of the rule of law. And there is, I think, sort of a fundamental disconnect between the idea of sending drones into mountains and blowing people up and the rule of law, right? Because, you're sending people into this territory and there's obviously no trial, there's no jury, there's no defense, right? We simply assert that we have a certain level of evidence, and then we go and we kill people. And there is a tension between that and between a sort of law-guided vision of foreign policy. Now, in terms of, Eli Lake had an article today about the effectiveness of the drone war, whether the drone war can be justified on it in terms of its practical consequences, which is, practical consequences also ought to be an element of a progressive security policy. And Eli's argument echoed the argument that I've heard from other intelligence professionals, which is that the drone war is just magnificently effective. That it has shattered the capabilities of Al Qaeda, that it has the Pakistani Taliban just seriously freaked out all the time, that it's extremely effective not simply in killing the leaders of these organizations, but also in terrifying them and preventing them from communicating.
Mm-hmm.
Just because intelligence professionals tell you this over and over again doesn't mean that it's actually true, right? Because if it weren't true, they would probably still tell you that. But I just keep hearing over and over again that this is just a fabulously successful program, even though we can't actually present the evidence that it's fabulously successful for obvious reasons. And so that, too, makes it really difficult, right? Because, from a progressive point of view, it's probably better just to try to kill the few people there than to, send 9 divisions into Pakistan and try to root everyone out, right? I mean, that just seems like a terrible idea. So, but it's one that I think is problematic from a progressive point of view. It evokes the tensions in a progressive foreign policy understanding, which doesn't mean necessarily that it's bad, but it evokes the tensions.
Well, I think you bring up some great points here. I mean, one is that there is no law on drones. One of Peter's points in his book on this is that the law has not at all caught up to this. You treat a drone like you treat an airplane with a pilot in it, in which case they follow the laws of war, just like an airplane. If an enemy shoots at a drone,
mm-hmm.
is it like shooting at a pilot? Should we treat it as an act of war, even if the pilots are back in Nevada?
Right.
Really interesting, difficult questions, and law has not caught up with them, and I think it's incumbent on those who want warfare to follow some ethical rules
mm-hmm.
for the lawyers to start engaging with the actual warfare we've got and not with the warfare they would like us to have.
Right.
I think it is fair to say that with precision-guided missiles, with the drones, with all of these new technologies, we've actually moved in such a far direction toward progressive ways of waging war that it's almost impossible to see how far we've come. Mm-hmm. You know, we've moved in 50 years, 60 years from World War II, when with conventional bombing, we actually killed more civilians in Dresden, in Germany, than we did with the bomb, the nuclear bomb in Hiroshima. People forget that
our
conventional bombing was just meant to terrify civilians often, to now when we try to not kill anyone, and when we get deaths in the dozens, mm-hmm. it's a huge incident, and it should be a huge incident, but it's great progress.
Mm-hmm.
But I think ending on your point here about the efficacy is important, because too often as progressives, I think we look very much at all the caveats to war. How do we avoid killing civilians? How do we put it within law? How do we wage this in the most ethical possible way? And that's all good, and that's all mm-hmm. right. But one thing you want to do in warfare is win as quickly as possible and end the war. Certainly no one wants war, and no one thinks that it's a good thing. It might be a necessary thing. And so weapons that help us end war more quickly, even if they might seem horrific, and I've heard the same thing you have from intelligence professionals and from soldiers about the effects of UAV on the enemies, it's a good thing to end war more quickly and to be out more quickly with success. And it kills less people and it disrupts fewer lives the faster that you can end that. So weapons that do that faster, it's not just weighing efficacy against ethics. It's part of the ethical consideration, it seems to me.
The practical is part of the ethical, right? Which needs to be sort of any, you know, almost all, or not almost all, but many conceptions of just war do include that practical element, right? That even if you have a just war, if you can't practically achieve what you want to achieve, then it's not just to wage the war.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, Michael Walzer would be happy with that conclusion, I think.
I suppose.
Our just war theory, but it was mm-hmm. such a pleasure to talk with you. I hope that we haven't bored all of our Blogging Heads listeners by agreeing, but really a pleasure.
Well, hopefully we didn't. You know, I think we said we had interesting things to talk about and interesting things to work through. So even though there wasn't any fireworks and sort of fighting, at least I think that there was some stuff to chew on. So it's been very good having this conversation with you, Rachel.
Absolutely. Look forward to a future one.
All right. Bye-bye.